pioneering pragmatists, 19th century Americans, among them proper Bostonians of an intellectual bent, had a habit of joining clubs. Luminaries such as the philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson, the novelist Nathaniel Hawthorne, and the natural scientist Louis Agassiz regularly met for sumptuous food and social conversation at the Saturday Club. Younger members of Boston's polite society mimicked their elders at a junior edition known simply as the Club. In a world without academic conferences or professional forums, serious intellectual conversations in the United States tended to occur at private philosophical and literary societies, or simply at regular gatherings in a scholar's home study. One club, founded in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in January 1872, lasted only 9 months, but its members left an indelible mark on American intellectual life. It was in the earliest 70s that a knot of us young men in old Cambridge, calling ourselves, half ironically, half defiantly, the Metaphysical Club, used to meet, sometimes in my study, sometimes in that of William James, recalled Charles Sanders Peirce in 1907. Peirce's Metaphysical Club was hardly a success by most conventional standards. It kept no records of its proceedings. Its members missed meetings and except for Peirce made no mention of its existence in their letters, diaries, or writings. Some of their relatives despised it. A young Henry James novelist, brother of William Gripe, "It gives me a headache merely to know of it." But it did boast an impressive roster of members, including three young men in their early 30s who eventually became foundational figures in their respective fields, the logician and scientist Peirce, the medical doctor, Psychol August, and philosopher William James, and the jurist and legal scholar Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. With their Harvard friend and fellow philosopher Chauncey Wright, they assembled frequently in their homes and, usually over a bottle of rum, argued over the meaning of life and the nature of the universe. Joined later by the philosophers John Dewey and George Herbert Mead, these thinkers gave earliest expression to a distinctive American philosophy known as pragmatism. Pragmatism sprouted in the fertile intellectual soil of the late 19th century Atlantic world. The ground had already been tilled by the naturalist Charles Darwin, whose revolutionary contributions to evolutionary science greatly influenced the early pragmatists. In place of fixed species, Darwin had posited a natural world of chance, change, and contingency. Thinkers like Peirce and James applied Darwin's insights from biology to fields such as philosophy, logic, and psychology. To them, old ways of thinking that assumed absolute truths, sanctioned by religious teaching or idealist philosophy, no longer made sense in the Darwinian age. Instead, they welcomed the provisional, fallible nature of experimental knowledge. As James put it, pragmatism means the open air and possibilities of nature, as against dogma, artificiality, and the pretense of finality and truth. In short, they embraced uncertainty and developed an entire philosophical system around it. The true value of an idea, said the pragmatists, lay in its ability to solve problems. While all the pragmatists were far-ranging in their intellectual pursuits, Dewey demonstrated his faith in the unity of theory and practice by becoming a public intellectual and social activist. He founded the Laboratory School at the University of Chicago in 1896 to experiment with an educational philosophy rooted in learning by doing. He promoted an ethical vision of American society by linking arms with progressive reformers in the 1910s, and he championed democratic ideals by promoting third-party politics in the 1930s and anti-Stalinist agitation in the 1940s. Throughout a prolific career that spanned three generations, Dewey continually stressed the positive virtues of experience, cooperation, and democracy, and he urged philosophers to abandon futile debates about knowledge in favor of tackling the real problems of men. Holmes, as a justice on the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court for 20 years and on the U.S. Supreme Court for another 3 decades, similarly followed pragmatism's injunction to evaluate the effects of ideas rather than simply adopt prescriptions from the past. From his personal experience fighting in the Civil War, where he nearly died from his wounds, Holmes acquired a bleak skepticism toward jurisprudence. While on the bench, he became renowned for his masterfully crafted dissents, most famously asserting the principle of judicial deference to legislatures in Lochner v. New York and protecting freedom of speech, even freedom for the opinions that we loathe, in Abrams vs. United States, 1919. Many commentators on pragmatism have considered it the quintessential expression of American practicality. To its critics, pragmatism symbolizes the vulgar, can-do attitude and narrow anti-intellectualism of the American middle class. To its celebrants, pragmatism offers a needed correction to conventional philosophy by accepting the uncertain and provisional nature of knowledge, reconciling science and culture, and promoting an ethical ideal of democracy. Pragmatism went out of fashion during the Cold War era when Americans believed in moral certainties such as the superiority of the United States or the value-free empiricism of science. But it has enjoyed a striking renewal in recent years. As new kinds of uncertainty ranging from terrorist violence to scientific dilemmas raise fresh challenges in the 21st century, many modern American intellectuals are harking back to pragmatism. First formulated in the cozy confines of Cambridge's Metaphysical Club more than a century ago, pragmatism offers today's thinkers a philosophy of life built on experimentation, ethical commitment, and open-ended democratic debate. An even more popular writer was Horatio Alger, a Puritan-reared New Englander, who in 1866 forsook the pulpit for the pen. Deeply interested in New York newsboys, he wrote more than 100 volumes of juvenile fiction that sold over 100 million copies. His stock formula was that virtue, honesty, and industry are rewarded by success, wealth, and honor, a kind of survival of the purest, especially non-smokers, non-drinkers, non-swearers, and non-leaders. Although Alger's own bachelor life was criticized, he implanted morality in the conviction that there is always room at the top, especially if one is lucky enough to save the life of the boss's daughter and marry her. In poetry, Walt Whitman was one of the few luminaries of yesteryear who remained active. Although shattered in health by service as a Civil War nurse, he brought out successive, and purified, revisions of his hardy perennial, Leaves of Grass. The assassination of Lincoln inspired him to write two of the most moving poems in American literature, O Captain, My Captain, and When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed. The curious figure of Emily Dickinson, one of America's most gifted lyric poets, did not emerge until 1886, when she died and her poems were discovered. A Massachusetts recluse, she wrote over 1,000 short lyrics on scraps of paper. Only two were published during her lifetime, and those without her consent. As she wrote, how dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog to tell your name the lilelong June to an admiring bog. In novel writing, the romantic sentimentality of a youthful era was giving way to a rugged realism that reflected more faithfully the materialism of an industrial society. American authors now turned increasingly to the coarse human comedy and drama of the world around them to find their subjects. Two Missouri-born authors with deep connections to the South brought altogether new voices to the late 19th century literary scene. The daring feminist author Kate Chopin wrote candidly about adultery, suicide, and women's ambitions in The Awakening. Largely ignored in her own day, Chopin was rediscovered by later readers, who cited her work as suggestive of the feminist yearnings that stirred beneath the surface of respectability in the Gilded Age. Mustachioed Mark Twain had leapt to fame with the celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County and The Innocents Abroad. He teamed up with Charles Dudley Warner in 1873 to write The Gilded Age. An acid satire on post-Civil War politicians and speculators, the book gave a name to an era. With his scanty formal schooling in frontier Missouri, Twain typified a new breed of American authors in revolt against the elegant refinements of the old New England school of writing. Christened Samuel Langholm Clemens, he had served for a time as a Mississippi riverboat pilot and later took his pen name, Mark Twain, from the boatman's cry that meant two fathoms. After a brief stint in the armed forces, Twain journeyed westward to California, a trip he described, with a mixture of truth and tall tales, in Roughing It. Many other books flowed from Twain's busy pen. The Adventures of Tom Sawyer preceded The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, an American masterpiece that defied Twain's own definition of a classic as a book which people praise and don't read. His later years were soured by bankruptcy growing out of unwise investments, and he was forced to take to the lecture platform and amuse what he called the damned human race. A great tribute was paid to his self-tutored genius, and to American letters, when England's Oxford University awarded him an honorary degree in 1907. Journalist, humorist, satirist, and foe of social injustice, he made his most enduring contribution in recapturing frontier realism and humor in the authentic American dialect. Another author who wrote out of the West and achieved at least temporary fame and fortune was Bret Hart. A foppishly dressed New Yorker, Hart struck it rich in California with gold rush stories, especially The Luck of Roaring Camp and The Outcasts of Poker Flat. Catapulted suddenly into notoriety by those stories, he never again matched their excellence or their popularity. He lived out his final years in London as little more than a hack writer. William Dean Howells, a printer's son from Ohio, could boast of little schoolhouse education, but his busy pen carried him high into the literary circles of the East. In 1871 he became the editor-in-chief of the prestigious Boston-based Atlantic Monthly and was subsequently presented with honorary degrees from six universities, including Oxford. He wrote about ordinary people and about contemporary and sometimes controversial social themes. A modern instance deals with the once taboo subject of divorce. The Rise of Silas Latham describes the trials of a newly rich paint manufacturer caught up in the caste system of Brahmin Boston. A Hazard of New Fortunes portrays the reformers, strikers, and socialists in Gilded Age New York. Stephen Crane, the 14th son of a Methodist minister, also wrote about the seamy underside of life in urban, industrial America. His Maggie, a girl of the streets, a brutal tale about a poor prostitute driven to suicide, was too grim to find a publisher. Crane had to have it printed privately. He rose quickly to prominence with the Red Badge of Courage, the stirring story of a bloodied young Civil War recruit, Fresh Fish Under Fire. Crane himself had never seen a battle and wrote entirely from the printed Civil War records. He died of tuberculosis in 1900, when only 29. Not all authors came from humble stock. The gifted Henry Adams, son of Charles Francis Adams, grandson of John Quincy Adams, and great-grandson of John Adams, turned unrivaled family connections into a prolific career as a historian, novelist, and critic. In his 9-volume History of the United States during the administrations of Jefferson and Madison, Adams defended his patrician heritage from posthumous attack. Alarmed by modern trends, Adams penned a paean to the bygone beauty and spiritual unity of the High Middle Ages in Mont Saint Michel and Chartres. Similar anxieties about modernity resurfaced in his best-known work, The Education of Henry Adams, an autobiographical account of his own failure to come to grips with the chaotic forces of 20th century life. Henry James, brother of Harvard philosopher William James, was a New Yorker who turned from law to literature. Taking as his dominant theme the confrontation of innocent Americans with subtle Europeans, James penned a remarkable number of brilliant novels, including Daisy Miller, The Portrait of a Lady, and The Wings of the Dove. His book The Bostonians was one of the first novels about the rising feminist movement. James frequently made women his central characters, exploring their inner reactions to complex situations with a deftness that marked him as a master of psychological realism. Long resident in England, he became a British subject shortly before his death. Candid portrayals of contemporary life and social problems were the literary order of the day by the turn of the century. Jack London, famous as a nature writer in such books as The Call of the Wild, turned to depicting a possible fascistic revolution in The Iron Heel. Frank Norris, like London a Californian, wrote The Octopus and Earthy Saga of the Stranglehold of the Railroad and Corrupt Politicians on California Wheat Ranchers. A sequel, The Pit, dealt with the making and breaking of speculators on the Chicago Wheat Exchange. Two black writers, Paul Laurence Dunbar and Charles W. Chestnut, brought another kind of realism to late 19th century literature. Dunbar through poetry, particularly his acclaimed lyrics of lowly life, and Chestnut through fiction, short stories in the Atlantic Monthly and The Conjure Women, embraced the use of black dialect and folklore, previously shunned by black authors, to capture the spontaneity and richness of southern black culture. Conspicuous among the new social novelists rising in the literary firmament was Theodore Dreiser, a homely, gangling writer from Indiana. He burst upon the literary scene in 1900 with Sister Carrie, a graphically realistic narrative of a poor working girl in Chicago and New York. She becomes one man's mistress, then elopes with another, and finally strikes out on her own to make a career on the stage. The fictional Carrie's disregard for prevailing moral standards so offended Dreiser's publisher that the book was soon withdrawn from circulation, though it later re-emerged as an acclaimed American classic. Victoria Woodhull, who was real flesh and blood, also shook the pillars of conventional morality when she publicly proclaimed her belief in free love in 1871. Woodhull was a beautiful and eloquent divorcee, sometime stockbroker, and tireless feminist propagandist. Together with her sister, Tennessee Claflin, she published a far-out periodical, Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly. The sisters again shocked respectable society in 1872 when their journal struck a blow for the new morality by charging that Henry Ward Beecher, the most famous preacher of his day, had for years been carrying on an adulterous affair. Pure-minded Americans sternly resisted these affronts to their moral principles. Their foremost champion was a portly crusader, Anthony Comstock, who made lifelong war on the immoral. Armed after 1873 with a federal statute, the notorious Comstock Law, the self-appointed defender of sexual purity, boasted that he had confiscated no fewer than 202,679 obscene pictures and photos, 4,185 boxes of pills, powders, etc., used by abortionists, and 26 obscene pictures, framed on walls of saloons. His proud claim was that he had driven at least 15 people to suicide. The antics of the Woodhull sisters and Anthony Comstock exposed to daylight the battle going on in late 19th century America over sexual attitudes and the place of women. Switchboards and typewriters in the booming cities became increasingly the tools of women's liberation. Economic freedom encouraged sexual freedom, and the new morality began to be reflected in soaring divorce rates, the spreading practice of birth control, and increasingly frank discussion of sexual topics. By 1913, said one popular magazine, the chimes had struck 6 o'clock in America. The new urban environment was hard on families. Paradoxically, the crowded cities were emotionally isolating places. Urban families had to go it alone, separated from clan, kin, and village. As families increasingly became the virtually exclusive arena for intimate companionship and for emotional and psychological satisfaction, they were subjected to unprecedented stress. Many families cracked under the strain. The urban era launched the era of divorce. From the late 19th century dates the beginning of the divorce revolution that transformed the United States social landscape in the 20th century. Urban life also dictated changes in work habits and even in family size. Not only fathers but mothers and even children as young as 10 years old often worked, and usually in widely scattered locations. On the farm, having many children meant having more hands to help with hoeing and harvesting. But in the city, more children meant more mouths to feed, more crowding in sardine tin tenements, and more human baggage to carry in the uphill struggle for social mobility. Not surprisingly, birth rates were still dropping and family size continued to shrink as the 19th century lengthened. Marriages were being delayed, and more couples learned the techniques of birth control. The decline in family size in fact affected rural Americans as well as urban dwellers, and old stock natives as well as new immigrant groups. Women were growing more independent in the urban environment, and in 1898 they heard the voice of a major feminist prophet, Charlotte Perkins Gilman. In that year the free-thinking and original-minded Gilman published Women and Economics, a classic of feminist literature. A distant relative of Harriet Beecher Stowe and Catherine Beecher, Gilman displayed the restless temperament and reforming zeal characteristic of the remarkable Beecher clan. Strikingly handsome, she shunned traditional feminine frills and instead devoted herself to a vigorous regimen of physical exercise and philosophical meditation. In her masterwork of 1898, Gilman called on women to abandon their dependent status and contribute to the larger life of the community through productive involvement in the economy. Rejecting all claims that biology gave women a fundamentally different character from men, she argued that our highly specialized motherhood is not so advantageous as believed. She advocated centralized nurseries and cooperative kitchens to facilitate women's participation in the workforce, anticipating by more than half a century the daycare centers and convenience food services of a later day. Fiery feminists also continued to insist on the ballot. They had been demanding the vote since before the Civil War, but many high-minded female reformers had temporarily shelved the cause of women to battle for the rights of blacks. In 1890, militant suffragists formed the National American Woman Suffrage Association. Its founders included aging pioneers like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who had helped organize the first women's rights convention in 1848, and her longtime comrade Susan B. Anthony, the radical Quaker Spitfire who had courted jail by trying to cast a ballot in the 1872 presidential election. By 1900, a new generation of women had taken command of the suffrage battle. Their most effective leader was Carrie Chapman Catt, a pragmatic and Buccinus-like reformer of relentless dedication. Significantly, under Catt, the suffragists emphasized the argument that women deserved the vote as a matter of right, because they were in all respects the equals of men. Instead, Catt stressed the desirability of giving women the vote if they were to continue to discharge their traditional duties as homemakers and mothers in the increasingly public world of the city. Women had special responsibility for the health of the family and the education of children, the argument ran. On the farm, women could discharge these responsibilities in the separate sphere of the isolated homestead. But in the city, they needed a voice on boards of public health, police commissions, and school boards. By thus linking the ballot to a traditional definition of women's role, suffragists registered encouraging gains as the new century opened, despite continuing showers of rotten eggs and the jeers of male critics who insisted that women were made for loving, not for voting. Women were increasingly permitted to vote in local elections, particularly on issues related to the schools. Wyoming Territory, later called the Equality State, granted the first unrestricted suffrage to women in 1869. This important breach in the dike once made, many states followed Wyoming's example. Paralleling these triumphs, most of the states by 1890 had passed laws to permit wives to own or control their property after marriage. City life also fostered the growth of a spate of women's organizations, including the General Federation of Women's Clubs, which counted some 200,000 members in 1900. The reborn suffrage movement and other women's organizations excluded black women from their ranks. Fearful that an integrated campaign would compromise its efforts to get the vote, the National American Woman Suffrage Association limited membership to whites. Black women, however, created their own associations. Journalist and teacher Ida B. Wells inspired black women to mount a nationwide anti-lynching crusade. She also helped launch the Black Women's Club movement, which culminated in the establishment of the National Association of Colored Women in 1896. Alarming gains by Demon Room spurred the temperance reformers to redoubled zeal. Especially obnoxious to them was the shutter-doored corner saloon, appropriately called the Poor Man's Club. The barroom helped keep both him and his family poor. Liquor consumption had increased during the nerve-wracking days of the Civil War, and immigrant groups, accustomed to alcohol in the old country, were hostile to restraints. Whiskey-loving foreigners in Boston would rudely hiss temperance lecturers. Many tipplers charged, with some accuracy, that temperance reform amounted to a middle-class assault on working-class lifestyles. The National Prohibition Party, organized in 1869, pulled a sprinkling of votes in some of the ensuing presidential elections. Among the favorite songs of these sober souls were "I'll Marry No Man If He Drinks," "Vote Down the Vile Traffic," and "The Drunkard's Doom." Typical was this, "Now, All Young Men, A Warning Take, and Stun the Poison Bowl. 'Twill lead you down to Hell's Dark Gate, and ruin your own soul." Militant women entered the alcoholic arena, notably when the Women's Christian Temperance Union WCTU was organized in 1874. The white ribbon was its symbol of purity. The saintly Frances E. Willard, also a champion of Planned Parenthood, was its leading spirit. Less saintly was a muscular and mentally deranged Kansas Cyclone, Carrie A. Nation, whose first husband had died of alcoholism. With her hatchet she boldly smashed saloon bottles and bars, and her hatchetations brought considerable disrepute to the prohibition movement because of the violence of her one-woman crusade. But rum was now on the run. The potent anti-saloon league was formed in 1893, with its members singing "The Saloon Must Go" and "Vote for Cold Water, Boys." Female supporters sang "The Lips That Touch Liquor Must Never Touch Mine." Statewide prohibition, which had made surprising gains in Maine and elsewhere before the Civil War, was sweeping new states into the dry column. The great triumph, but only a temporary one, came in 1919, when the National Prohibition Amendment 18th was attached to the Constitution. Banners of other social crusaders were aloft. The American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals was created in 1866 after its founder had witnessed brutality to horses in Russia. The American Red Cross was launched in 1881, with the dynamic and diminutive 5-foot-tall Clara Barton, an angel of Civil War battlefields, at the helm. John Adams had anticipated that his generation's preoccupation with nation-building would allow art to flourish in the future, but the results long proved unspectacular. Portrait painting continued to appeal, as it had since the colonial era, but many of America's finest painters made their living abroad. James Whistler did much of his work, including the seal-braided portrait of his mother, in England. This eccentric and quarrelsome Massachusetts Yankee had earlier been dropped from West Point after failing chemistry. Had Sillikin been a guess, he later jested, I would have been a major general. Another gifted portrait painter, likewise self-exiled in England, was John Singer Sargent. His flattering but somewhat superficial likenesses of the British nobility were highly prized. Mary Cassatt, an American in exile in Paris, painted sensitive portrayals of women and children that earned her a place in the pantheon of the French Impressionist painters. Other brush wielders, no less talented, brightened the artistic horizon. Self-taught George Innes, who looked like a fanatic with his long hair and piercing gaze, became America's leading landscapist. Thomas Eakins attained a high degree of realism in his paintings, a quality not appreciated by portrait sitters who wanted their moles overlooked. Boston-born Winslow Homer, who as a youth had secretly drawn sketches in school, was perhaps the greatest painter of the group. Earthily American and largely resistant to foreign influences, he revealed rugged realism and boldness of conception. His canvases of the sea and of fisher folk were masterly, and probably no American artist has excelled him in portraying the awesome power of the ocean. Probably the most gifted sculptor yet produced by America was Augustus St. Gaudens. Born in Ireland of an Irish mother and a French father, he became an adopted American. Among his most moving works is the Robert Gould Shaw Memorial, erected in Boston in 1897. It depicts Colonel Shaw, a young white Boston Brahmin officer, leading his black troops into battle in the Civil War. Music, too, was gaining popularity. America of the 1880s and 1890s was assembling high-quality symphony orchestras, notably in Boston and Chicago. The famed Metropolitan Opera House of New York was erected in 1883. In its fabled Diamond Horseshoe, the newly rich, often under the pretense of enjoying the imported singers, would flaunt their jewels, gowns, and furs. While symphonies and operas were devoted to bringing European music to elite American audiences, new strains of homegrown American music were sprouting in the South. Black folk traditions like spirituals and ragged music were evolving into the blues, ragtime, and jazz, which would transform American popular music in the 20th century. A marvelous discovery was the reproduction of music by mechanical means. The phonograph, though a squeakily imperfect instrument when invented by the deaf Edison, had by 1900 reached over 150,000 homes. Americans were rapidly being dosed with canned music, as the sitting room piano increasingly gathered dust. In addition to skyscraper builder Louis Sullivan, a famous American architect of the age was Henry H. Richardson. Born in Louisiana and educated at Harvard and in Paris, Richardson settled in Boston and from there spread his immense influence throughout the eastern half of the United States. He popularized a distinctive, ornamental style that came to be known as Richardsonian. High vaulted arches, like those on Gothic churches, were his trademark. His masterpiece and most famous work was the Marshall Field Building in Chicago. Enjoying his success, Richardson was noted for his capacity for champagne, his love of laughter, and the bright yellow vests he sported. A revival of classical architectural forms, and a setback for realism, came with the Great Columbian Exposition. Held in Chicago in 1893, it honored the 400th anniversary of Columbus's first voyage. This so-called dream of loveliness, which was visited by 27 million people, did much to raise American artistic standards and promote city planning, although many of the spectators were attracted primarily by the contortions of a hoochie-coochie dancer, Little Egypt. Fun and frolic were not neglected by the workaday American. the pursuit of happiness, heralded in the Declaration of Independence, had by centuries and become a frenzied scramble. People sought their pleasures fiercely, as they had overrun their continent fiercely, and now they had more time to play. Varied diversions beckoned. The legitimate stage still flourished, as appreciative audiences responded to the lure of the footlights. Vaudeville, with its coarse jokes and graceful acrobats, continued to be immensely popular during the 1880s and 1890s, as were minstrel shows in the South, now performed by black singers and dancers rather than by whites wearing blackface as in the North before the Civil War. The circus, high-tented and multi-ringed, finally emerged full-blown. Phineas T. Barnum, the master showman who had early discovered that the public likes to be humbugged, joined hands with James A. Bailey in 1881 to stage the greatest show on earth. Colorful Wild West shows, first performed in 1883, were even more distinctively American. Headed by the knightly, goateed, and free-drinking William F. Buffalo Bill Cody, the troupe included war-whooping Indians, live buffalo, and dead-eye marksmen. Among them was the girlish Annie Oakley. Rifle in hand, she could at 30 paces perforate a tossed-up card half a dozen times before it fluttered to the ground, hence the term Annie Oakley for a punched ticket, later for a free pass. Baseball, already widely played before the Civil War, was clearly emerging as the national pastime, if not a national mania. A league of professional players was formed in the 1870s, and in 1888 an all-star baseball team toured the world, using the pyramids as a backstop while in Egypt. Basketball was invented in 1891 by James Naismith, a YMCA instructor in Springfield, Massachusetts. Designed as an active indoor sport that could be played during the winter months, it spread rapidly and enjoyed enormous popularity in the next century. A gladiatorial trend toward spectator sports, rather than participative sports, was exemplified by football. This rugged game, with its dangerous flying wedge, had become popular well before 1889, when Yaleman Walter C. Camp chose his first All-American team. The Yale-Princeton game of 1893 drew 50,000 cheering fans, while foreigners cheered that the nation was getting sports on the brain. Even pugilism, with its long background of bare-knuckle brutality, gained a new and gloved respectability in 1892. Agile gentleman Jim Corbett, a scientific boxer, wrestled the world championship from the aging and alcoholic John L. Sullivan, the fabulous Boston Strong Boy. Two crazes swept the country in the closing decades of the century. First, croquet became all the rage, though condemned by moralists of the naughty 90s because it exposed feminine ankles and promoted flirtation. Second, the low-frame safety bicycle came to replace the high-seated model. By 1893 a million bicycles were in use, and thousands of young women, Joe Kesters remarked, were turning to this new spinning wheel, one that offered freedom, not tedium. The land of the skyscraper was plainly becoming more standardized, owing largely to the new industrialization. Although race and ethnicity assigned urban Americans to distinctive neighborhoods and workplaces, to an increasing degree they shared a common popular culture, playing, reading, shopping, and talking alike. As the century drew to a close, the explosion of cities paradoxically made Americans more diverse and more similar at the same time.